Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. LGBT groups around the country, including some in the first state, say they're ready to lobby for stronger gun laws in the wake of this month's mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando.
The NRA needs to be aware that we're coming for them.
We discuss the issue this week with Camp Rehoboth CEO Steve Elkins. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in with political reporter James Dawson for an update on action this week in Delaware's General Assembly, and head to the Rehoboth Art League for our arts playlist. Plus, we bring you this month's History Matters and another story from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As the national debate over gun laws heats up again, Delaware's General Assembly passed a gun control measure this week. But questions linger about the fate of redistricting Wilmington schools and portions of the state budget. And a candidate for governor dips his toe into the debate over marijuana. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson was at Legislative Hall all week covering these stories and more, and he is back to chat with us as we enter the final week of session. James, thanks for joining us again on The Green this week.
Hey, happy to be here, Tom.
Well, it starts with guns and gun control. Lawmakers passed and Governor Markell signed a bill closing a gun sale loophole. What does this new law do, and was getting it through the General Assembly expected?
On a basic level, if you've never had a problem with processing your background check while you're buying a gun, this new law probably won't affect you. So right now, the federal background check system has 3 days to finish your report. And if they don't complete it, your local firearm dealer can finalize that gun sale for you. Now, state law will extend that waiting period to 25 days before you might be able to walk out of that store with a gun. As for getting it through, there was a period of time where passage in the Senate was uncertain. Democrats had it on the agenda for several days and continued to skip over it when they couldn't lock down the votes. That 25-day waiting period itself was a compromise. When it was originally introduced, the time frame was 30 days. And before that, the initial proposal was actually an indefinite period, meaning you don't have a clear background check, you don't get a gun. It did eventually pass, obviously, like we said, with one moderate from each party switching sides in the Senate.
Very interesting. There was, of course, also a no-fly, no-buy rule banning those on the terror watch list from buying guns that came up this week in the General Assembly. It wound up being tabled. Any chance that will come back in the final week, or is that maybe just something that those who are really interested in reacting to the shooting in Orlando wanted to at least make a statement with?
Sure. I honestly don't see it coming up again. The Legion of Opposition is pretty strong on this topic, from the National Rifle Association to the American Civil Liberties Union. Both argued that the no-fly list and the terror watch list, which prevent people from getting on airplanes, are heavily prone to error in their current forms. So the ACLU has sued several times over the use of that list, mostly because it denies due process. Mm-hmm. People who appear on these lists don't know it until they show up at an airport gate and they're told they can't board and they have no idea why. The government doesn't have to tell them either as far as the evidence against them, and there's no appeals process to get your name off that list. And because those documents are classified, there's also a question of whether or not it could even be implemented just from a state-by-state level, since it's not illegal for someone on those lists to buy a gun right now at a federal level. We saw a few similar bills introduced in Congress recently, but none of them could even get enough support for debate on the floor, which led to the Democratic sit-in in the House earlier this week.
So a lot of this is kind of just an opportunity for those who are looking to move on gun laws to show that they have an interest in doing so, which brings me to the next question. Is there a sense that gun control advocates here are feeling a bit more emboldened and perhaps may make a push next year for things like an assault gun ban, limiting magazines, large magazines, measures that we did see a few years ago in the wake of the Sandy Hook school shooting that didn't gain traction then?
It's certainly possible. The Delaware Coalition Against Gun Violence, which I should say is led by two former state politicians, has ramped up their lobbying efforts in the background for the past year or two, I would say. And with that being said, I haven't heard of any further movement for banning high-capacity magazines or assault weapons. If they were to bring back the assault weapons issue, I think they'd have a hard time overcoming the complete bungling of the last attempt to do so. Back in 2013, like you mentioned, shortly after Sandy Hook, lawmakers swore the gun owners who already had or already owned these type of weapons would be allowed to keep them and that there wouldn't be a registry. And what happened? The bill created a registration system which completely burned any chance that measure would get debated. The other problem for Democrats is that they've lost seats in both the House and the Senate, making the margin to pass these bills pretty slim, and they have members of their own caucus which typically do vote against gun issues, gun control issues.
And also it'd be a bit of a different issue because back in 2013, leading the charge were Governor Jack Markell and then Attorney General, the late Beau Biden. They both would not be involved in anything that happens next year. Governor Markell is finishing out his term, likely to be somebody, will be somebody else in office. That would also, I guess, kind of change maybe the tenor of it as well.
Yeah, that's right. And we don't know where exactly Congressman John Carney stands on any of these issues, since he's the apparent front runner as the sole Democrat who's running for governor. We generally know where Senator Combinini stands and Lacey Lafferty, who's his Republican opponent. But we have no idea about gun control as far as Carney is concerned or any of his priorities should he become governor.
And we know that Matt Dehn was part of that push a couple years ago as lieutenant governor, though it doesn't seem like something that he has made a major priority of his as attorney general at this point.
No, he really hasn't waded his toes into the water on this one, aside from maybe modifying sentencing guidelines, but that's about it.
Okay. The final DFAC revenue estimate came in on Monday, offering no relief to budget writers, actually a little less money available. With the general fund spending plan largely in place, introduced at the end of the week, that means uncertainty with bond bill and grant and aid. Where do things stand with those two pieces of the budget?
Oh, they're still uncertain. If you want to talk dollar figures, lawmakers have $41.6 million left to split between grant and aid and bond bill. Earlier this week, the Joint Finance Committee did meet to refinance some government bonds, which rakes in a little more than $7 million. State budget officials are also poring over spreadsheets to see what capital projects might be behind schedule in the current year that could, scoop a few more pennies into the change jar. And the $6 million for the Wilmington school redistricting effort could come into play as well. Factor in an 8% proposed cut to most nonprofits in grant and aid, and lawmakers are just waiting for finalized figures before making a move next week.
You mentioned that money budgeted for the WIAC redistricting plan for Wilmington schools could be available. That plan did pass the House this week, but even if it passes the Senate, which is uncertain, it may be put on the back burner because of the costs. It's estimated at $7.5 million, and WIAC officials say it's pretty much $7.5 million or bust, correct?
Yeah, that's right. WIAC Chair Tony Allen told us Wednesday that he'll suspend the redistricting efforts for another year if they can't get that $7.5 million. Well, I guess what I see happening is the Senate signs off on these redistricting bills that don't commit to a specific funding source, even though it's going to be a tough vote. It absolutely will be a tough push in the Senate. Without enough money to pay for it this year, lawmakers can absorb that $6 million into either grant and aid or bond bill, and then they get to continue debate on WIAC for another year, but crucially in a non-election year for those who might feel pressured.
I was going to say for WIAC, it may be a decent plan to get it approved this year, realize you're going to have to suspend it because the funding's not there, and then come back, as you said, in a non-election year and haggle over the money, but at least you know you've got the approval to do it already in place.
Exactly. And then it's just you get 6 months to a year to figure out whether or not a statewide property tax reassessment might be in play, or allowing districts to raise property or tax revenue without a referendum.
And I guess because they're not going to get much help, presumably, from the state budget and revenues next year. The revenue estimates don't suggest that there's going to be an extra pool of money available for anything, including WIAC, come next year.
Well, there's talk of the next governor possibly raising corporate taxes, which could the figure I've heard thrown around is about $100 million. Mm-hmm. But it's unknown if that would get eaten up by the prevailing forces with the economy. So that's not even a slam dunk right now, even though maybe in January it might look like they have an extra $100 million to spend around.
Okay. Let's finally talk about Republican candidate for governor, State Senator Combinini, who made news at the end of the week coming out in favor of legalizing marijuana. What prompted what I guess most would say is a pretty stunning move?
Yeah, I can't speak to his motives, but Benigni says it's because the state should more strictly regulate marijuana, since he says they already have a de facto legalization system in place. We saw the passage of decriminalization come last year, and there's been rumblings of a bill to legalize it recreationally for you know, at least the past few months for that I've heard, and that bill could come next year. We don't know exact details of his plan, but he says he'd limit it to those 21 years or older, with tax proceeds going to addiction treatment programs. And like you mentioned, this is fairly unprecedented since. Congressman John Carney doesn't support it. Governor Jack Markell doesn't support it. Attorney General Matt Dehn doesn't support it. And Lacey Lafferty certainly does not support it.
Is it likely to be much of a campaign issue? And I guess could Bonini look at it from the economic standpoint? Like, hey, this is a potential revenue source?
It's not so much that. It's just that he feels that actually he did tell me that he would rather roll back all of these new regulations that they have in place, whether it's for decriminalization or medical marijuana. He would rather just go back to it being completely scheduled as a dangerous substance. But it definitely differentiates himself in the field, that's for sure. Like I said, Congressman John Carney supports decrim, but not full legalization. And Lacey Lafferty on Twitter yesterday said it would be, quote, the end of civilization if recreational marijuana were to become legal. I think it's likely to steal votes away from Lafferty, who has billed herself as a Tea Party alternative. But a significant wing of that Tea Party leans libertarian, and legalized marijuana has been a big issue for them. As for the general election, a single issue like this just doesn't seem strong enough to overcome the steep voter registration advantage Democrats have.
Sure. Well, it's going to be interesting to watch how it plays out one way or the other. Political reporter James Dawson, we thank you so much for being with us again on The Green this week.
Thank you.
And as always, you can find all of James's coverage of the legislature and politics in the First State anytime at our website, DelawarePublic.org.
This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Following the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida this month, LGBT leaders issued an open letter declaring their commitment to fight for stricter gun laws. The heads of 122 LGBT centers, representing more than 2 million people, signed that letter in less than 24 hours. Delaware's two largest LGBT groups, Camp Rehoboth and Equality Delaware, have joined that fight. Delaware Public Media's James Morrison spoke to Camp Rehoboth CEO Steve Elkins earlier this week and asked Elkins if he thinks the LGBT community has the power to break the National Rifle Association's successful lobbying efforts against national gun control legislation in Congress.
Well, you know, I saw something earlier this week that said you've picked on the wrong group when you start picking on the LGBT community, because we are really successful at organizing and bringing the issues to the forefront. I mean, Delaware especially, we worked for 11 years to pass employment non-discrimination that added sexual orientation. We started in 97, and it was in 2009 that bill was finally signed, so almost 12 years. But then it took us 11 months to pass civil union bill and about 7 months to pass same-sex marriage. So we're organized, and we're ready to take this battle on.
Gun control legislation, would you consider this a gay rights issue even before the shooting in Orlando?
You know, I wouldn't have thought of it that way. It's been mentioned to me that we're obviously concerned about domestic violence and abuse and assaults against people that are gay or lesbian that are confronted with guns and confronted with partners who have weapons and access to weapons. So in hindsight, yes, this has been an issue that we should have been focusing on. Had we done that? No, we have not done a good job with that.
Now that this is becoming more of an issue, focusing on gun control legislation, what do you expect to happen now moving forward, coming out of this mass shooting and having this focus on gun control legislation?
Well, we had really exciting news in the Delaware Senate yesterday when the background check law was changed to make it 25 days that a gun dealer would have to wait for the federal background check to come about. And it's really an important thing. So we're seeing movement state by state.
LGBT organizations, is there a lot of money behind some of these organizations, or are bodies just sheer strength in numbers? Is that where you get your source of strength?
You know, the source of strength comes obviously from the numbers and people that are willing to go out and to make phone calls and to go out and knock on doors and to go out and join protests. But there's no doubt that the LGBT community, to a large degree, has a lot of available money to put behind these types of things. It's been referred to over the years as the gay mafia that would support a candidate or support a cause. That's not the nicest term to use, but it gets the point across that the money is there, and if we start directing our resources toward issues such as this, I think we can be very successful with it and very quickly.
What are some of the examples of tactics that different, you know, LGBT community organizations may use to try to push a sensible gun control legislation? Is it just strictly focusing on lobbying efforts here in Delaware and in Congress? What are some examples of...
Well, I think the best example is in the late 80s and early 90s with HIV and AIDS. That's what taught our community how to organize and how to raise money and how to raise political awareness and how to make our points with legislatures across the country. That's where we learned, and that's where we cut our teeth on that. We've taken that, as you obviously know, for civil unions throughout most of the states and then for marriage equality. We've shown that the money is there, the will is there, and the organization is there. And I think if we put our same efforts toward gun control, sensible gun control, nobody, or some people, but most of us are not saying get rid of guns. We're not saying that hunters can't go out. I have a nephew that's one of the most avid hunters that I've ever met, but everything that he shoots, he eats, or his family eats. He said, why in the world would I need an assault weapon to go turkey hunting? There wouldn't be any turkey left, and there wouldn't be any sport in it. So people like that are sensible, that we have family members, that we need to bring them to the side of sensibility and understanding that something has to be done. We're not going to get rid of all instances like this, all types of terrorist activities, but if you can save just a couple of lives, if we can just make it so much harder for somebody that in the heat of a moment is going out and buying a gun or doing something where it's retribution and a domestic violence attack, if we can just stop any of those, then I think it's worth it.
LGBT communities, you were very successful last year in marriage equality, but the NRA, I mean, this is a really, you know, big and well-funded organization, and I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of success you expect having, you know, going up against someone like the NRA?
No organized group has been really willing or funded in a way to ably go against the NRA. But it's not just the LGBT community. We're being joined by Mothers for Gun Control. There was a new group in Delaware that was lobbying on at Legislative Hall yesterday, and I happened to see photographs with women that I knew that have children that are saying, as a mother, we've got to do something. So I think when we start bringing these organizations together, then we can put together a coalition that's going to be pretty awesome to have to go up against. So the NRA needs to be aware that we're coming for them.
What are you hoping to get? What kind of gun control legislation are you hoping to see on the local and then maybe even the more national level to come out of Congress?
Well, I think it's become clear that we need to limit the sale and control the sale of semi-automatic weapons, large capacity magazines. We need to expand background checks, and we need to limit the availability of guns to people who have a history of violence, a history of domestic abuse, or back to what most of the Republicans actually agree with, people that are on a terrorist watch list. There's no reason those people should have access to guns at all, but especially high-capacity guns.
Where do you go from here? So what are you doing in the near term, today, tomorrow, working towards this objective?
What we're doing is, as you mentioned, is working with a coalition of other LGBT organizations throughout the country and throughout the world, but especially within the U.S., that are saying, let's organize. I was on the phone with one of my state senators this morning. We need to be organizing not only in the legislatures, both state and federal, but we may need to be organizing with our fundraising abilities. And with an election coming up, we can make a difference.
Our thanks to Camp Rehoboth CEO Steve Elkins for his time this week on The Green.
Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. Lewis is a city with a rich history. It was founded in June 1631, the first city in the first state. It was a key port for ships making their way to Philadelphia and even home to what historians claim is the first shipyard owned by free African Americans. And shipbuilding, which played a key role in the evolution of industry and livelihood in the town, is still alive there today, but more as an art than an industry. Since 2010, the Lewis Historical Society has hosted a unique wooden shipbuilding event open to families during Father's Day weekend. In this month's History Matters, produced in conjunction with the Delaware Historical Society, Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly tells us more about this event and the history of shipbuilding in Sussex County.
During the 2016 Father's Day weekend, six families gathered to build small 12-foot flat bottoms, essentially rowboats. The event, one of a few wooden boat-building events scattered across the country, is popular, with typically over 100 families on the waiting list in a given year. Families work together over the weekend to physically build the boat with the help of seasoned volunteers.
You guys are fantastic.
Yeah, what do you think?
Great.
The Franklin family this year came all the way from Huron, Ohio to participate. They've been coming to Delaware for 16 years and even have a Delaware-themed nautical room in their house. Renee Franklin says they've been on the waiting list for the boating event before.
You know, we've done the kayaking, canoeing, paddleboarding, so now we'll get a rowboat.
Some parts are pre-cut, but many pieces are cut on-site and fitted to the boats as they're being built. The boats are reminiscent of a lost era when the shipbuilding and fishing industries were booming in Lewis. The shipbuilding industry in Lewis was born of necessity. Transportation on land was very difficult, with no main roadways in the 1600s.
The canal has been the life's blood of Lewis. We are the first town in the first state, ironically, without a first street.
That was Marco Salaveria, Director of Education for the Lewis Historical Society. And he says the famed gentlemen of Lewis were its pilots or ship commanders tasked with helping ships navigate towards Philadelphia and other ports.
They were like any other trade of that era. You started off as an apprentice. You kind of went through a testing period. You became a master. Their skills were sought because still to this day, a lot of the waterways around our area are very shallow, shifting shoals and shores.
The pilots relied on ships coming up and down the canal to earn a living, and the primary ships they were commanding, called schooners, had two masts.
They were competing against each other. Pilots would be competing. You'd buy into a pilot boat. You might have an eighth share, or a 16th, or a 32nd share, even a 64th share.
That's Mike DiPaolo, executive director of the Lewis Historical Society. He says from the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, pilot boats played a key role in defending Delaware.
Shallops, sloops, schooners, barges, whatever was at hand, was used to sort of harass the British out in the bay.
Sloops were slightly smaller than schooners, typically with one mast, and shallops were even smaller, built to navigate narrow waterways. DiPaolo pointed to a map of the channels in the 1700s.
You can see how shallow some of this is in feet. You know, so the main ship channel back then is 14 feet, 8 feet. Couple ship channels, the main ship channel, the western main ship channel.
However, as natural resources dwindled and the demand for larger ships grew, these larger boats were built in towns like Milford and Bethel, further inland.
So when you moved to Milford, you moved to Milton, you had forests nearby. You also had elevation changes for the mills to help in the process, and Lewis didn't have that.
A 1929 Milford Chronicle article indicates that white oak was abundant in Sussex County at the time and was among the finest in the United States, with thousands of dollars worth being shipped to other parts of the country. The schooner evolved into a larger ship known as the Ram, over 100 feet long.
And how it got its name, the Ram, the first one that went through the C&D Canal, the lock operator said, look at that boat ramming its way through the lock.
That's Kevin Phillips, president of the Bethel Historical Society. He says the launching of the ships, which took months to build, was quite the affair.
School was closed, everybody came.
The ships were built on an incline, and a ship rail car, remnants of which can still be seen at low tide, helped guide the ship into the water. Only one ram is still in use today in Maine. The Vineyard Shipyard, also known as the Milford Shipyard, is the last of Milford's shipyards still in existence. It dates back to 1896. The shipyard earned fame through government contracts to build submarine chasers, wooden ships that German submarines couldn't detect with their sonar in both World War I and World War II. Meanwhile, the fishing industry was still alive in Lewis. Lewis was the breeding ground for the menhaden fish, an oily fish that can't be eaten by humans but provided all of the oil for colonial lamps before whale became popular. And it's still popular today, a key ingredient in many fish oil supplements. Salaveria describes the early fishing process.
It's catching the schools of 100,000, 300,000 fish. This is the net reel before the invention of nylon. It is dried, not hand dried, but literally foot dried. It looks like a giant hamster wheel. Four men, there are graded steps inside of the wheel. Four men would stand inside and walk and turn the wheel.
The industry swelled during and after the Civil War, and by 1880, over 60 factories dotted the coast, up as far north as Maine. It continued into the 1960s when plane spotters helped locate schools of fish from the air.
And what they would do is a message, literally message in a bottle. Inside of a Coke bottle, they'd have a message. They'd drop it from the plane and drop into the water, and the boat would go over. They'd pick it up. They'd open up. They'd unroll the note, and it's the coordinates of the fish.
The invention of nylon and overfishing eventually ended the menhaden industry in Lewis. Bob Katowski volunteers for the Lewis weekend shipbuilding event as a yard boss, helping direct the families through the shipbuilding process step by step.
Yeah, flip the boat over.
Katowski says the boats being built for the families over Father's Day weekend were similar in size, though a bit smaller, than what was considered a gunning boat in the late 1800s to 1900s.
It was actually a market. They would take these boats, they would row them up the creek. They go to the Great Marsh, which is up north and slightly west of the town. Once in there, whoever was rowing would get up and take a 16-foot pole and pull it through the marsh. And the gunner would stand up there, and they would go gunning for waterfowl.
At the finale of the shipbuilding event on Sunday, disabled Army veteran James Talby is working on his boat. His opportunity to build the boat with his family came through a partnership between the Lewis Historical Society and fishingcommunity.org, an organization that helps assimilate veterans back into the community.
For me, I've wanted to build a boat since I was knee-high to a grasshopper.
Upon returning from a deployment to Iraq, he was diagnosed with PTSD. He says being by the water and out in nature is therapeutic.
Seeing the animals, the birds, the bees, the trees, you know, it's all a very relaxing atmosphere and definitely has become a critical part in my therapies.
He plans to use the boat to go fishing with his sons. After completing the 16-hour process of building the boat, they got to test it out before taking it home.
All right, good job. Let's go.
The Franklin family took their boat back to Ohio in a U-Haul and says they're still deciding on a color to paint theirs. Megan Polly, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Megan. And you can learn more about this topic when you visit History Matters on our website, DelawarePublic.org. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Rehoboth Art League is celebrating its 43rd annual Members Fine Craft Exhibition. It features everything from pottery to hand-woven baskets. And in our latest arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart takes us on a tour of the exhibit, which runs through July 24th.
So I'm here with Jay Pastor, and you're with the Rehoboth Art League.
Correct.
And this is the 43rd Members Fine Craft Exhibition. And what exactly is this event?
This event is a large collection of works from, we have over 700 member artists. They're invited to bring up to 5 pieces of work for the show.
Okay, and there are pieces of all sorts of different categories. There is pottery work, there's fiber work, there is woodworking, and what else?
There's glassworks, wearable art, as you said, different types of pottery, raku, porcelain, paperworks, handmade paper, and just works that fall into miscellaneous categories of craft, just decorative works using mixed media.
Sure. And so a lot of this is, it's not fine art, it's more functional, but it's just as beautiful as fine art, right?
Correct. There's a fine line between fine art and craft. Most of this work is functional, and it really does blur the line between fine craft and fine art.
Let's go take a look at the works that won Best in Show. So we're walking over to a bunch of elaborate baskets, but they're not normal baskets that you would make in basket weaving class. They have wooden elements, and they're just almost amorphous. What can you tell me about these baskets and why they won?
So this basket is the one Best in Show. The artist, her name is Bea Whitehead. And Bea's interesting because she's actually 90 years old. She started making baskets approximately 20 years ago. Well, they're just really beautiful. She uses natural sticks for some of the handles. They're just really interesting shapes that really require a lot of skill to make. The one that won Best in Show is made of cane, sugar palm, reed, rope, and as she says, a hard-to-find frame and handle of honeysuckle vine and seagrass.
Wow,
so it's really an exquisite piece.
Yeah, she looks like she puts her heart and soul into these, and she is 90 years old, but she is so talented. These things are amazing. Absolutely. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 baskets here, and they look like nothing else I have ever seen. They are amazing.
And because she won Best in Show, she'll be offered a solo show next year as part of next year's Members Fine Craft Show.
So Beatrice Whitehead will have a featured show at the 44th Correct. Annual Fine Craft. So moving along here, we have some really great pottery, and it looks like it has some sort of, I want to say, horsehair woven into it?
Yes. This artist's name is Roz Weinberger, and these are really wonderful vessels. They look very much like antiquity vessels, but she puts horsehair into them. And then some of the interesting glazes she puts on top really give them a different feel than usual vessels.
I'm looking at a piece of pottery here, and you can definitely tell where the horsehair is woven into it, but it's a pale pink, almost like it was from the Southwest.
Yeah, it has that kind of, I guess, Mojave sort of feel.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's excellent.
But her colors are really wonderful.
Yeah, we have some pale pinks, some bright ivories, some really exquisite deep greens here. And these pottery pieces are all shapes and sizes. Over here, we have a series of wooden boxes, but this is where the craft kind of meets the fine art, in my opinion, because these boxes almost look like the wood grain is acting as marble, and they have even little hands carved into them and little eyes, and they're just amazing. What can you tell us about these series of boxes?
The artist's name is Michael Quattro Ciocchi, which is a difficult Italian word to say, but he's a Delaware artist also, and he's actually won a lot of awards, and I think he may have just been asked by the vice president to make a box for him. Michael was also selected to build the Governor's Award for the Arts in 2014, which is an award that's given to outstanding Delaware artists. But his marquetry, when he puts when he lays wood to sort of create images inside, is really wonderful.
Absolutely. What can you tell me about this one? It's called Trapped, and you can see a set of eyeballs on the bridge of a nose and a right hand jutting out almost like there's somebody in the box.
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece. Inside is just an empty box, but he uses marquetry with mother of pearl and different types of wood to create this sense of a face being inside the box and peering out with a hand also coming out as if someone's trapped in the box. And for him, this represents any life experience that one may feel overwhelmed. The hand is crafted from walnut, and there's a zebra wood inlaid on the top of the box.
Amazing. I wonder what somebody would put inside there.
I don't know. Some of them he actually makes that. This piece here can have 72 compartments in it, so if somebody could put their jewelry, earrings. Some of them, this one has, is three-tiered and it has 105 compartments in it. Some have false bottoms that one could place jewelry in that you wouldn't necessarily see when you open the box. So they're very functional, but also, as you said, they just really sort of bridge the gap between fine craft and fine art.
And this one is a humidor, right?
It's a humidor that holds up to 100 cigars, and it smells really good when you open it up.
Oh, it does smell good. Absolutely.
Yeah, this is really wonderfully done.
It's a beautiful.
I don't think there's anyone in Delaware that does this type of wood that I'm aware of.
And then there are some pieces over here, and from about, I don't know, about 6 yards, it looks like a painting, but as we're getting closer, I can see that it's a forest scene, but it's stitched. The background is stitched, and it's just a bunch of layers of cloth.
Yeah, the artist's name is Betsy Von Driel, and this definitely sort of, to me, because it's hanging on the wall as a two-dimensional piece. If you didn't know it was fiber, you would just think it was a really interesting painting. It has so much depth to it. Even when you realize that there's stitching in the front and fiber creating the landscape, you still aren't aware that the deep background with these really light trees in the back, you wouldn't even think they could be stitched. I mean, it's really incredible work.
And our thanks to our Mark Earhart and the Rehoboth Art League's Jay Pastor for their time this week walking us through the Rehoboth Art League's 43rd Annual Members Fine Craft Exhibition. And again, that exhibition is on display through July 24th. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. College tuition costs have been on the rise for decades and have reached new heights in recent years. According to the Institute for College Access and Success, graduates from Delaware's four-year public higher education institutions, Delaware State and the University of Delaware, had the highest average debt in the nation in 2014 at $33,808. In light of looming loads of debt for new students, some students from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at Mount Pleasant High School, who are just beginning to search for colleges themselves, decided to talk to experts about why college costs are so high and what can be done to keep costs down for students. They also followed another student search and ultimately decision on where to go to school as part of this week's Enlighten Me.
I'm Jared.
And I'm Shemira, and we're both juniors at Mount Pleasant High School and are starting to think about college and what we want to do with our lives. Since the amount of student debt is now higher than America's collective credit card debt, we decided to talk to some experts on the topic of higher education about why costs are so high and to a student who already has gone through the process of selecting a college. Here's what we found out.
So far, this is the biggest choice of my life.
For Noah Lockwood, a senior at Mount Pleasant High School in Bellefonte, Delaware, choosing college has been a major process. He just signed his letter of commitment with a scholarship for shot put at East Stroudsburg University.
It's very stressful because you just don't know what you want to do when you're 17 or 18 and you just don't have your life planned out.
We decided to talk to him about this process in light of rising higher education costs across the nation. Along with Noah, we had phone conversations with two other experts on this topic, Shauna Payne, who is the Delaware Department of Education's Director of Higher Education, and Dr. John Thielen, a professor at the University of Kentucky and author of A History of American Higher Education.
Over the last probably 10 years, college tuition has been on the increase as colleges are looking to upgrade their facilities and offer more programs for students.
That's Shauna Payne. She says one of the reasons for the rising costs is a need for more student housing. Dr. Thielen says it was a different story 70 years ago when higher education was reserved for only extremely wealthy. Then after World War II, when the GI Bill was introduced, a large number of veterans started receiving affordable higher education. Then the demand skyrocketed, pushing the cost of college higher for generations to come.
While Noah is a senior now, he started searching for the right school for him when he was a junior. But college and its high costs have been on his mind much longer than his 4 years in high school.
College has been on my mind ever since grade school.
And with the whole process, definitely came some stress.
It has been very annoying and stressful because you don't know where you want to go and then how much you want to spend and if you're getting scholarships or not. Yeah, it's very exciting and kind of scary at the same time because you don't know where it's going to lead to.
Luckily for Noah, he is a 2016 shot put state champion for the state of Delaware and placed second in the state for discus, and ESU recognized him for that, and Noah received a scholarship for his education so he does not need to pay full tuition. He will only be about 90 minutes away from home.
I would rather stay close to home because then you have the comfort of your parents and they're like less than an hour away so they could get you whatever you need.
The school he chose only has 7,353 students enrolled currently at the school.
I want to go to a small college because you get more one-on-one time with the teacher and there's less students in there.
The cost of tuition at ESU since Noah is out of state is around $32,000 each year, but Noah will not be paying that because of the scholarships he continues to receive. Even $32,000 is relatively inexpensive for a Pennsylvania school.
Dr. Thielen gave us some information about the time he spent in college in California and how there was no cost for college tuition in any California university or college.
Time when I was going to school, California had a policy of no tuition charge for the University of California and for the California State Colleges and the community colleges.
In today's world, free college is a rare occurrence, unless you are some phenomenal athlete or graduate at the top of your class and get perfect scores on your standardized test. In other words, you're more likely to get struck by lightning than go to college for free. Noah said that he does plan to take out some student loans with the help of his parents to pay it back. He is very fortunate that his parents are going to help him pay off his debt.
Some colleges are much more expensive than other colleges, and it's just hard, especially when you don't have the money.
While Noah got help from his parents and school in his search of the right college for him, he feels like there should be more done to help students through the process.
Yes, colleges have helped with my FAFSA. Filling out your FAFSA helps a lot because you get some scholarships and some grants that help out.
The FAFSA is a great way for students to earn all different kinds of scholarships, and it happens to be free and it's very easy.
Payne says there are many different scholarships available for students in Delaware, but student loans are still common. Dr. Thielen says high costs can be a major barrier for students and even contribute to students dropping out.
The dropout rate has always been fairly high, and I think what happens in the United States, we're better at helping students get into college and get enrolled, but we are still lagging behind in understanding and helping students so that they complete their degrees and don't drop out.
Thielen says it was much easier to pay for college debt-free when he was a student.
Fairly realistic that you could support yourself by working and by financial aid to go through college without debt, and I think that's harder to do today.
He says that eventually the cost of college will have to go down, but in the meantime, he thinks college should be made more affordable for students.
And going more toward student grants that a student would not have to repay, I think that would do a lot of good for everyone and for the nation in terms of helping more students go to college and complete college.
Noah is trying to just focus on his career now and not worry too much about his student loans.
I want to go to school for exercise science. And I would love to be an athletic trainer or a weightlifting coach for a sports team.
After going back and forth with himself and his family about what he wanted to major in, he finally chose exercise science over business. He hopes his career is fruitful enough that he isn't in debt for the rest of his life.
I don't know if my future is going to pay off thousands of dollars of college tuition.
For WMPH and Delaware Public Media, I'm Jared.
And I'm Shamira. Thanks for listening.
And our thanks to Mount Pleasant High School juniors Jared Munoz and Shamira Rambawa for enlightening us this week.
And a reminder, this story is part of Generation Voice, a collaboration between Delaware Public Media and the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. Remember, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, our Generation Voice students at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, James Morrison, and Megan Pauley, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.